take this opportunity to welcome you. I was just thinking how to introduce you. Since you are one of the people who have actually done a full cycle, you were once here, sitting one sitting today, in the government, in the reserve bank, in the private sector, back into the reserve bank. So you have done a full cycle.
We have
a very
large press contingent in here, but also we have visitors from Botswana and Lesotho in our midst today. I want to welcome all of you as our special guests today. In fact, it's the whole of SADC, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Namibia, Swaziland, Tanzania, and I think these are the countries that I can see here represented, or delegation from those countries. Now, it is not just an ordinary meeting for us. Honorable members and our distinguished guests, and in particular the Reserve Bank itself, you will be aware that this has been a very hectic year. We have missed three meetings with yourselves, not because of your fault, but because of our parliamentary program. We had
to perform two meetings,
scheduled meetings. And at some point there was a press comment by one member of the opposition to say, for the second time, the Reserve Bank has not been able to come and present a quarterly report to Parliament. I want to put it on record that it was not as a result of the Reserve Bank, its unwillingness to come and meet with us in Parliament. It was because of our abnormal schedule as a committee. Towards the end of the term of the previous governor, I had to consult with members of the committee, in particular the opposition, what would be best for us as Parliament and the committee to have two successive meetings or just to have one. And our better conclusion was that we should actually have a meeting with yourselves as you walk into your hot seat.
It is not an easy place to be. And we are very, very much grateful that within almost 10 days of your assuming your responsibility, you found space and time to come and meet with Parliament. And I hope this is the basis on which you are going to begin to work, and work very closely. Thirdly, we also said to ourselves, the majority of committee members are new members. And as an experienced person in this field, you'd know that the task and responsibilities of the Reserve Bank are not as common as other people would want to imagine. Therefore, it will be important that ordinary members and honorable members of the committee should then be afforded the opportunity to understand the internal operations of the bank. It will not be exhaustive today, but it will be important that we go through that process. We'll also be looking forward from yourself to give us additional information in terms of where and the direction that we intend to take in terms of leading these very important institutions, given the challenges that we're going through today. You are not only meeting the Standing Committee on Finance, we have also members of the Appropriation Committee on my left, or to my left, is Honorable Chair of the Appropriation Committee, Mr. Sogoni. We also have two important committees in the NCOP, Standing Committee on Finance and Appropriations, and the chairpersons are here, but I only see Mr. Dipier. Mr. Dipier, you're welcome. And we thought we would also depart from the normal practice of the committee today, where we normally request presenters to present from the positions or the seats they are sitting, and make a special arrangement for the governor of the Reserve Bank to make a presentation from the seat here. It is reserved for you. And I've been trying to consult whether I'm breaching any rules of parliament. Hence, you've been seeing us communicating here, even caucuses here, and all those kinds of things. But we think it's quite important that we allow you so that you have a feel of what it used to be like to sit here. Thank you very much, Honorable Governor of the Reserve Bank. Yeah. Over to you, Governor. You'll help us in terms of just introducing your team. Some of them have been around. We know their faces, but it will be important that we all have a sense of who is here.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And it really is a privilege to be with you today and to do so early in taking up the responsibilities in the Reserve Bank. I think the relationship with Parliament is an extremely important one. The Reserve Bank is a creature of the Constitution itself, and therefore it is a very useful and important vehicle to ensure an engagement with Parliament and through that with a wider audience in terms of the whole of South Africa. If I could introduce the team, first of all, perhaps for the purposes of Parliament, the most important here is Brian Hoger. Brian Hoger heads the Communication Division in the SARB, and he is the person responsible for liaison with Parliament and the committees. So this is Brian Hoger, and that's why we thought it would be useful for you to know who it is, that when you're trying to get us down here and in any way we are resistant, which will not be the case, you can just get hold of Brian and he'll make sure there's a three-line whip. Deputy Governor Daniel Manele. Daniel Manele is a recently appointed Deputy Governor, and he is responsible for the financial markets area of the bank. That is the area that he was working in before. And he will do a presentation on the work of financial markets and the engagement of the Reserve Bank. And then Brian Kahn, who is the Deputy Head of Research. Is that correct? I always forget titles a little bit, and I'm still learning so many in the bank. But Brian is responsible for the work on monetary policy, the inflation targeting side of things, the monetary policy review, and this is certainly one of the most outstanding economists in this country with that particular knowledge. And that is going to take a little bit more time in our presentation today, because we feel that this whole issue is a very topical one. It's something there's a lot of conversation about. And perhaps to give you a feel of the data and the depth to which we examine issues when we're looking at taking a decision on interest rates. So with that background, what I'd like to do is perhaps just give you a little bit of an overview of the Reserve Bank. In every country, there's only one, or there should only be one. Ours is one with a very long tradition. It has a number of unique features. in that it is one of the few central banks in the world that is held by shareholders. The shareholders are entitled to have up to 10,000 shares each at a maximum, and whether you're an institution or an individual, you can only hold 10,000 shares and have one vote at the AGM. The idea behind behind that was to have a broader public ownership, that you would not have a major shareholder, that it would not be answerable, and I'm talking about from the public. Most banks are owned by the government or by the state, not by the government, by the state. There's a handful that are owned in a variety of private arrangements. Ours is one of the few. What it means is that you have 2 million shares in issue, of which anyone can only hold up to 10,000. The idea behind it is that there is no individual or organization that can have undue sway over the bank, and you have a wide ownership. In that, you have an annual general meeting, and the government appoints 3 shareholders. The government or the president appoints the governor and the 3 deputy governors. This is in terms of the Saab Act, so the legislation provides for a governor and 3 deputy governors, for the government to appoint 3 representatives to the board, and for the shareholders to elect the other 7. The board constitutes 14 people, and of the 7 that are elected by the private sector at an AGM, or appointed and ratified at an AGM as you would have in any company, they are designated areas of where the people are supposed to come from and represent. So that the idea is to input into the board knowledge of what is happening in those sectors. So, for instance, you have board members who come from agriculture, from finance, from trade, from mining. So that the idea behind it is that it strengthens the board with knowledge of what is happening in those sectors. The governor has a casting vote, should that ever be required, so that it ensures that the position of, if you like, the bank itself is protected by the role of the governor, and if there was to be any difference of view between the private sector and government appointees. The bank has a number of very key responsibilities, and I'll run through them reasonably quickly. What we thought about today was to rather go in depth in a couple of areas than give you simply a big overview. And Chairperson, I'd like to, at this point in time, so that I don't forget, invite you and your committees at any time that's convenient for you to actually come to the Reserve Bank and therefore just get a feel and go. You can go through the different departments, have presentations on them, see the people who are involved, so that would be an open invitation to whenever it's convenient for you, and we can arrange that. From the Saab. The Reserve Bank does a number of very key functions that, and perhaps just a starting point on it, this is an institution for public good. It does not prioritize, or it's not, its objective is not to make a profit. Does not mean that we do not make profits, but the profits are there to, in terms of ensuring that we have the resources to do what we need to do. But it is not an institution designed to make profits. If you look at the world at the moment, you'll see most central banks, because of the decisions you need to take are often in the interest of the country and not in the interest of the institution. If you were driven by a profit motive, you would take decisions that affect your profits and your bottom line. Very often a central bank takes decisions that is not in the interest of the bottom line, and that in fact is against the interests of the bottom line, but is in the interests of what needs to be done in the country, what needs to be done for the system. A central bank is there to work and safeguard the system of a country, and to certainly participate in regional and global systemic issues to ensure that there is a global stability. So I think that's a very important point in relation to the shareholding and the way the institution is seen. Because, as I said, and I would repeat that, it is an institution for public good that acts in the interests of the system and the country. It does a number of functions. For instance, we have a financial services department, and part of that task is to act as banker for government. So So that's a very key role. It's a lot of skill that's required. It's a unique skill because it is something that you don't learn in the public, in the private sector at all. But it is a very key role to ensure that government finances are managed and flow efficiently and effectively and properly accountable. The second area that is crucial to systemic stability, and that is the national payment system. When looked at it as a feature of the current global crisis that we have been experiencing and continue to experience, while you had globally, and South Africa, we can come back to this in question time if you like, but South Africa did not have a systemic banking crisis at all. Our banks are very well capitalized, and we've had a very stable banking environment. The banks are impacted on by the recession that we're in, but many parts of the world, particularly in the developed world, have had a major systemic banking crisis. And they have, at this point in time, trying to manage their dysfunctional banking system. One of the things in the banking system that was remarkable in that it held up, although there was pressure on it, it held up extraordinarily well, and that is the national payment, the payment system throughout the world. And that's a very important question because the payment systems tend to be closed. They tend to be to banks or through banks. And part of that is a network that's very well regulated. There's a lot of knowledge between the banking systems of different countries, the people and the players in that, a lot of interaction, because it really means that if you look at it, whether you're a country, a corporate, or an individual, and you spend money anywhere in the world, how does it get settled? In what time does it get settled and with whom? And that payment system that ensures that the banking system and the financial system as a whole works is one of the key functions of a central bank. And we have a very effective, regulated, and I think very well-run financial, the payment system in South Africa. The third area that we would look at is exchange controls. As you've seen in the Minister's medium-term budget policy statement, he eased some of the areas of exchange controls. This is a different function in the bank, in that the policy of exchange control is determined by the Ministry of Finance and the National Treasury. The central bank is the implementer of that policy. Obviously, there's discussions about what we see and what we don't see, but basically it is a delegated function to us. So it is housed in the central bank, but we are the implementers of policy, not the determinants of policy. A fourth area that I would like to just mention, which is crucial, and that is the Bank Supervision Department. Now, Bank Supervision is the regulator. It operates under the Banks Act. It is within and fully responsible to the South African Reserve Bank, excepting there are certain features of the Banks Act which require a collaboration with the National Treasury and the Minister of Finance. That would be, for instance, if there is a decision to hold a majority, if there was to be a purchase by a foreign bank of a South African bank, and they wanted to have a majority holding in that bank, it would need the Minister of Finance's approval, not the bank registrar. If it was a minority holding, the registrar can do it. I think it's up to 49% holding. Anything above that requires the minister's approval, which means that you're asking at that point in time not just the technical fits between that bank and others, but are there political issues that need to be taken into account? So bank supervision is very well regarded internationally. We participate in a lot of international forums in terms of banking supervision, and the South African banking regulator has got a very, very highly regarded reputation. In addition, if you looked at the current focus in the globe as to what needs to be done in terms of improving regulation, strengthening regulation, the lessons learned from this crisis, you'll find that many of the measures around capital adequacy, liquidity, reporting, and so on, South Africa had already implemented, so that when they're looking at what they need to do globally, we've already, in many of these areas, got at the level that they would like to achieve, we're already there. So it's not that we are complacent at all, it's just that we were much more prudent earlier on about some of the issues that we felt needed to be addressed to ensure stability in the banking system. And then finally, in terms of the areas of responsibility of the bank, and I'm not dealing with either the research department or the financial markets, which we're going to get the details of them. But those are two very big departments in the bank as well with core responsibilities. The other area would be the financial stability department. So again, at the moment, while many, one of the discussions being held in the global central banking environment and the national treasuries is that should financial stability become a mandate of central banks, what we found 5-6 years ago was that financial stability and macroprudential evaluation and monitoring and supervision is something that was crucial, and therefore we created a financial stability department at that time so that we ensured that while we were looking at the banks in specific, we would also look at the system issues through the financial stability department. So those are the core areas of responsibility of the central bank. We participate in a number of forums globally. South Africa is one of the, as far as I'm aware, the only African, sub-Saharan African country in the G20. That is led by the finance ministry rather than the bank, but we are also there as the central bank. It is done with both, but the G20 is led by the finance ministry. And that, of course, puts a lot of responsibility on us as South Africa, because it is our voice that, from a developing world perspective and the African continent, that we really need to be able to make effective input. And then secondly, we are the only central bank in sub-Saharan Africa as well that is in the Basel Committee of Central Bankers. You'll be interested to note that in that entire grouping, there are only three women governors, one the governor of Thailand, the governor of Malaysia, and the governor of South Africa in that grouping. And that committee meets every 2 months, and it looks at what is happening in the different countries. What do they see happening in the globe? What do they see as happening in terms of trends? And it is a very useful forum. But again, it puts a responsibility on us as being one of the few, I mean, the only African country there from sub-Saharan Africa. So part of the work that we would want to strengthen is our work on the continent with central bankers, so that when we are there, we actually have more of an input and able to interact with the different governors from central banks over the continent. That, in essence, is the structure and framework. There's a governor's committee, which comprises the deputy governors and senior management. We have, as I said, a full-functioning board with a normal board governance around audit committee, REMCO, etc. And it is an institution that is quite unique. I think it's a very great privilege to be part of that institution, and certainly an even greater privilege to be asked to be governor. It's an awesome responsibility that we take very seriously and examine things very carefully, because we know that whatever the decisions are that we take, they affect every single South African. So it is with that in mind that we really focus on the work that we do. So in brief, that is an overview of the bank and the task that we are responsible for. And you can see those are very core systemic functions in a country. Perhaps that's where I would like to stop there. And my suggestion is, if that's acceptable to you, Chairperson, in the House, is that we do all three presentations first and then open to questions. Would that be acceptable?
Great.
Okay. So perhaps we would then go, Daniel, to you, or Deputy Governor Manelli.
Thank you very much. Chairperson, honorable members of parliamentary committees, distinguished guests, thank you very much for the opportunity to interact with you this morning. My presentation will be on the role of the South African Reserve Bank in the financial markets, and just by way of an overview or outline of what I'm talking about, after some introductory remarks, I will share with you how we implement monetary policy, touch on the area of accumulation and the management of foreign exchange reserves, and the other activities that we pursue in the financial markets, and then maybe round off with the communication channels that we maintain with the financial markets. As stipulated in the Constitution, the bank's primary goal is the achievement and maintenance of price stability in the interest of balanced and sustainable economic growth. As the government has indicated, the current world financial crisis has prompted a significant debate around the proper management of monetary policy and its role in preventing and solving financial crisis. Central banks play a pivotal role in both price and financial stability. The achievement of price stability is underpinned by the stability of the financial system and financial markets, and therefore the bank actively promotes and contributes to financial stability, because financial stability is a basic requirement and an absolute prerequisite for sustainable growth and development. Just talking about the monetary policy framework, we distinguish between goal independence and instrument or operational independence. While the inflation target range in South Africa is set by government in consultation with the bank has a complete operational independence. That means that the bank can determine which instruments it will use to achieve its goal and has the autonomy to adjust these instruments as it deems appropriate. The inflation target, as you probably are all aware, currently is 3 to 6% for the measurement of CPI. This happens within a flexible exchange rate regime, meaning that the value of the currency is determined in the marketplace by the underlying forces of demand and supply. The MPC of the South African Reserve Bank determines the policy rate, which is the repurchase rate, as its key policy instrument, and makes the repurchase rate effective through the refinancing system. And under this refinancing system, banks meet their liquidity needs at the Reserve Bank so as to enable them to settle transactions with one another. And the liquidity needs include minimum statutory levels of reserves that the banks have to hold with the South African Reserve Bank. Now, moving on to the actual implementation of monetary policy, starting with the transmission mechanism. The repo system was introduced in March 1998 and has been modified on a number of occasions to keep abreast of changes in the domestic financial markets, but also with international developments. Through the Financial Markets Department of the bank implements the interest rate policy as determined by the Monetary Policy Committee, and does so by managing liquidity needs of the banking system as a whole. Under the repo system, the bank creates a liquidity shortage, and I'll touch on this a little bit more in a minute, a liquidity shortage in the money market, which it then refinances on a weekly basis at the repo or repurchase rate. The repurchase rate that influences interest rates charged by the commercial banks to their customers, the general level of interest rates in the economy, and therefore other economic variables such as money supply, credit extension, and ultimately the rate of inflation. The repo rate influences the bank's marginal cost of funding, and reflects, as I've indicated, the monetary policy stance of the Reserve Bank. Therefore, even if certain banks may not participate in our refinancing auctions, because typically in the main we have the four major banks participating there, all banks in South Africa, though, will adjust their interest rates in line with changes in the repo rate. This diagram, I think, illustrates essentially how the system works. The core of it is really the creation of this liquidity shortage in the money market, and it is necessary to ensure that the repo rate remains effective, that a liquidity shortage is created. So the SARB will drain liquidity to limit the amounts that banks can lend out to the private sector, as increased credit extension and excessive credit extension can fuel inflation. And the way in which the shortage is created can be done in various ways. I talked briefly about the cash reserve requirement, which is a requirement that stems from the Banks Act and puts an obligation on the banks to keep the 2.5% of their liabilities with the Reserve Bank. And in addition, so-called open market operations that the bank conducts would also implement impact on the liquidity requirement. And there we're talking about deposits that the government might make with the bank, or our own financial instruments that we issue, such as self-debentures or foreign exchange operations that we might be involved in the marketplace, or transactions that we conduct on behalf of the Corporation for Public Deposits. Having created that liquidity shortage in the market, it is then relieved or refinanced at the repurchase rate, and as indicated earlier, that then goes on to affect the bank's lending and deposit rates, and via that eventually affect other variables in the economy, such as your exports and savings and investments and the inflation rate, GDP, employment, and other factors. The factors that influence liquidity by way of either expanding the liquidity or contracting it or draining it are just listed here briefly, just that you get a sense of the kind of transactions that are involved there. I'll just pick up a few. For instance, if the Reserve Bank purchases foreign exchange in the market, we would obviously pay for that foreign exchange with rand, and that would be, for instance, a factor that would expand liquidity in the market. The decline in the amounts of some of our open market operations, if maybe they fall due and do not get rolled over or renewed, that would then lead to expansion as well. Government payments or declines in the CPD deposits at the bank, and examples of factors that would drain liquidity would obviously be the opposite of the transactions that we do on the expanding side, FX sales or increase in the outstanding debentures or reverse repos. If any government bonds that are maturing in the hands of the central bank that we may have in our portfolio, and payments that we make from the government or that the government makes to the Reserve Bank. The significant increase in foreign exchange purchases, for instance, of around $40 billion that we have at the moment over recent years would have created a lot of injection into the money market of liquidity. Now, the actual mechanics of relieving the shortage and refinancing...
Can I kindly ask the presenter that if, because now the abbreviations, they make me lost. If the abbreviations can be explained, like OMOs, we're not used to that language. Thank you.
Okay, my apologies. That OMOs refers to open market operations, which are transactions that the central bank conducts with financial market participants. In terms of the refinancing procedures, sometimes also referred to as the system of accommodation, that's a term that often gets used. There is a main repurchase auction that is conducted, you call repo auction, on a weekly basis on a Wednesday. At that stage, the Reserve Bank will announce a weekly range based on the estimates, and that estimates would have been calculated on the basis of the factors that I've just shown in the previous slides. Taking all of them into account, at the end of the day, we will come up with an estimate that says for the next week, we think that the banks might need so much money at the top or at the bottom, and also work out what the average for the week ahead it would be. That we will indicate to the market and to the market participants on that basis, they will look at their own situation and bid individually for their own requirements. And those bids, in principle, will be allocated in full, but obviously within reason given overall conditions. But in principle, they will get the full allocation. Lending to these banks as part of the pre-financing procedures is subject to eligible collateral. The Reserve Bank Act enjoins us to only lend against security, so we cannot lend unsecured. So there will be eligible collateral, and that collateral will be subject to what we call a haircut. That's got nothing to do with saloons, but to refer to a procedure whereby the value of the security in terms of its recognition as security is recognized as a slightly lower value to account for changes in market values, and to account for a situation where, should that security be need to be realized, that it can be realized fairly quickly in the market. And the reason for that stems from the process that on a daily basis we would mark to market the values of those securities. That means we would compare their market prices and then adjust our valuations on that. And depending on which way the values would have gone, so-called margin calls may become due, by way of which additional security gets posted or it gets released, depending on the value of that security. The securities that are eligible as collateral have traditionally been government bonds only, but in May 2007, we broadened the categories of eligible securities to include some bonds issued by parastatals. In addition to the weekly repo, the banks have access to a number of facilities because it is not sufficient to meet the market needs only once in a week. As fluctuations do occur during the course of the week, which will result in the market either being long or short in terms of liquidity, where liquidity may need to be injected or withdrawn from the market. And factors that could contribute to these fluctuations include government spending, the amount of notes and coin in circulation, our own open market operations by the Reserve Bank, foreign exchange purchases, as I've indicated earlier, and movements in the CPD accounts, which sometimes can be unpredictable. So there's got to be an opportunity for some element of what we call fine-tuning. If you could envisage the weekly refinancing auction as a quasi rough tuning, and anything that happens within that week by way of changes that might have occurred as fine-tuning. So the banks in this case will have access to the statutory cash reserve balances at the bank, which is that 2.5% cash reserve requirement I was talking about earlier. They can use those accounts, although subject to a constraint that within a particular month there is an averaging principle that applies there. Within the constraints of needing to maintain that average within a month, they can use those cash reserves. And in addition, there are standing facilities that are automatically available to them. Those, though, come with a small penalty, as such, in the sense that the banks will have, if they return money to us under these facilities, they get paid the repurchase rate minus 50 basis points, and if they borrow under these facilities, they get charged an additional 50 basis points. There is also another facility that can be used, which is a supplementary squirrel facility. These facilities are mostly used on an exceptional basis at the discretion of the Reserve Bank and apply in instances where, as part of the estimation and the calculation of the liquidity requirement, there could have been mistakes or there could have been estimates based on those varying factors that I've just mentioned that would be outside the control of the commercial banks. In that instance, the square of facilities will then be done at the repo rate. So as opposed to the previous standing facilities, there would be no adjustment by that 50 basis points that on an exceptional basis. But again, this is not automatic access. This one is at the discretion of the Reserve Bank. Just to give a bit of an example what this all means in terms of numbers and figures and the extent of the operations that are being conducted to drain liquidity and the utilization of each instrument. The light blue bars, they clearly shown as sort of the most dominant feature there. That is the deposit that the government keeps with the Reserve Bank, the so-called National Treasury Sterilization Deposit Account, currently at around 66 billion. Another big feature is the cash reserve account that I've just been talking about, at around 47 billion, followed by the South African Reserve Bank debentures, which is the green bars there, and to some what lesser extent than the use of CPD call deposits and reverse repos, those orange bars there, just to give you a sense of the magnitude of the operations. This slide just summarizes what I've just been saying around in terms of the extra liquidity requirement that gets calculated. This is the green shaded area shows the range that gets calculated and the actual amount that would have been allotted at the various repurchase weekly auctions. And as you can see here, for instance, there are times where these estimates are out and have to be then fine-tuned in the manner that we've talked about. Just then moving on to another very important area of the bank's work in the financial markets, which has got to do with accumulation and the management of foreign exchange reserves. Since 1998, the bank started to reduce what we call the NOFP, and the NOFP essentially relates to the extent to which the bank was committed to deliver the dollars into the future to market participants, which dollars were not covered by reserves that we had. So essentially a hole in our financial figures which had to be plugged. So in order to be able to accumulate reserves, we had to close out that oversold forward book and the NOFP, and that was achieved in February 2004 and started opening up the way to accumulate reserves. And just to illustrate that as well, the most recent figure of reserves that we released was just under 40 billion, 39.8, and about 10 or 11 years ago, that position, which comes on the next slide, was actually a net negative position. As you can see, at times, from the most recent low point, somewhere around 28 billion dollars, so a massive turnaround in this position. Since then, we have been accumulating reserves to get to this positive figure of almost 40 billion. And as you can see by the blue line there, for quite a long time, the only way we could show that we've got reserves was through borrowing on a net basis. The international liquidity position, what is essentially our net reserves, were negative. The issue around reserve management, there's some information there. The reserves are invested against benchmarks that are selected to reflect the risk-return profile of the Reserve Bank, and you would imagine that as a central bank, we would be conservative in line with what the governor has mentioned earlier on. We are not a fund manager aimed at maximizing profits for any reason. So to that extent, our risk profile, and as it gets embedded in benchmarks and guidelines that we give these fund managers, would be essentially very prudent and conservative. The objectives for reserves management, clearly, first and foremost, is to preserve capital and to make sure that we control risks in such a manner that we don't lose any of our reserves, to ensure that we can have these reserves from a liquidity perspective available in a timely manner, which obviously will impact on what types of instruments we allow people to invest in, and within very strictly controlled risk parameters, also embrace a moderate return enhancing strategy. The reserves are managed through a combination of internal and external fund managers, with the bulk of our reserves, over 80%, being managed internally, and a small portion being farmed out for management by external professional fund managers, both from the public sector as well as from the private sector. The reserves are tranched in three pieces. We've got the liquidity tranche, which basically is designed to meet the most immediate needs and the working capital requirements, and servicing the funding of foreign accounts and those kind of things, where we need to have these reserves readily available on a daily basis. And then there's an intermediate tranche, which we call the buffer tranche, which allows a slightly less liquidity and allows us to get a little bit more return, but is flexible enough to allow us to fund the liquidity tranche if needed. And whenever a call builds up in that area, that then gets transferred over to what we call the investment tranche, where we forego a little bit of liquidity and a little bit of return within those risk parameters that I've indicated. Just going back a little bit to illustrate the impact of the foreign exchange purchases on the domestic liquidity management. We purchase foreign exchange reserves for two reasons, and I think that is quite important to highlight in the wake of the various discussions that have been going on pertaining to the exchange rate and the activities of the bank in the foreign exchange market. They're really restricted to two objectives. First of all, as and when market conditions permit to accumulate foreign exchange reserves, and secondly, because we provide international treasury services to government and other clients to service those client requests. That would be, for example, if the government has a foreign loan and it needs to make a payment on that or interest payment, we would then go and acquire the foreign exchange reserves and deliver that to government to service those loans. These purchases, I've indicated, expand the money market, and in order to contain our money policy stance, that liquidity will need to be sterilized by our open market operations. We have to do offsetting transactions to withdraw that liquidity that would have been injected. And then there are other instruments that we use, so-called foreign exchange swaps, which are instruments that we essentially just use to smooth the money market, mostly intra-month, by way of actually swapping US dollars out of our portfolio for rands, by which then we can drain the rand from the system. But as I say, these transactions mature before the end of month. They tend to be very short term, a classic fine-tuning instrument. I'm coming towards the end, just to touch on other activities that by the Financial Markets Department, we are involved with in the financial markets. We act as an agent for government in their domestic debt management operations, and in that regard, we'll conduct bond and treasury bill auctions on behalf of government. We are responsible for the surveillance of primary dealers in government bonds. When government issues bonds, they do not issue them directly to the public. They issue them via a group of so-called primary dealers, and the Reserve Bank interacts with these primary dealers and ensures that they keep to the rules and regulations that we have agreed with them, and to make sure they participate and make a market in those bonds. So the surveillance function over those primary dealers rests with the Financial Markets Department of the South African Reserve Bank. I won't elaborate on the management of the CPD portfolio. I assume that member must will be aware with the CPD, the Corporation of Public Deposits, is a subsidiary of the bank, which manages investments on behalf of public corporations by way of pooling arrangements. So public corporations have accounts at the CPD, and we take those funds and invest them on behalf of the CPD in the financial markets. The government has touched on the role of banker to government, and another important function that happens at the financial markets is that of a lender of last resort, where support can be given to banks that find themselves under temporary liquidity constraints. These would be solvent banks, but that may have a liquidity, temporary liquidity situation to overcome, in close cooperation with the registrar of banks and the National Payment System Department. The Financial Markets Department here would become involved with the financial markets and the bank in that way by providing those facilities. In addition to that, the Reserve Bank compiled and published the so-called South African benchmark overnight rate on deposits, which is a benchmark rate that will indicate to financial market participants what their liquidity conditions in the money market are, and that rate gets collated through returns and information that we receive from the banks, and it gets published by the Reserve Bank. The activities on the national payment system, the governor's touched upon in describing the functions of the bank. That is a very, very important systemic function, and it's essentially the plumbing of any modern financial system. If your national payment system does not work efficiently and it's not safe and it's not robust, basically that can lead to the entire collapse of the system. Exchange control, as indicated, the policy remit rests with the minister, but the day-to-day administration of exchange controls and is then in the exchange control department of the bank. And as part of that, the bank would interact with financial market participants, given certain information that they need to provide, certain applications that they need to submit and get approvals for offshore direct investment, for instance, or individuals' allowances that exceed the limits, and those kind of things get administered by the exchange control department. And the banking supervision and the cooperative bank supervision, which is a relatively new responsibility in the bank, is also there to ensure bank regulation in South Africa so that the banking system is sound and efficient and that the interests of depositors are protected. The governor touched also on the financial stability issue. There again, the bank must be constantly alive to various trends that happen in the financial system and contribute to formulating and reviewing appropriate policies for intervention and crisis prevention and resolution. And this function, obviously, in the wake of the most recent financial crisis, have gained enormous importance in recent times. Additionally, our subsidiaries, the currency producing subsidiaries, the Mint Company and the Banknote Company, interact directly with the financial markets through the manufacturing of currency and the distribution. And members will have noted that some of these notes have got a new signature now. From a just a communications point of view and some of the channels that we maintain with the market there, we interact very, very actively with the financial market participants because we need to be able to understand developments in financial markets, and that happens in various ways. On any given day, there will be multiple contacts between the bank's foreign exchange desk and bond desk with the financial market participants. There is also a structured interaction with the banks that participate in our money market through what we call the money market liaison group. We meet about three times a year to basically consider any strategic issues pertaining to our money markets and to work out how further to enhance its effectiveness and efficiency. Another important element of our communication on a monthly basis, on the fifth working day of every month, the bank releases a statement on gold and foreign exchange reserves, from which statements stakeholders, market participants can glean any significant changes that might have occurred during the previous month in our reserve position, and any major changes there we tend to explain and give some commentary as to what would have occasioned those changes. In addition to that, speeches by the governors, deputy governors and officials of the banks are an important instrument of communication with the marketplace and interactions with institutional investors, both domestic and international, so that there's a two-way flow of information. Well, not only do we disseminate and give them the views from the bank, but it's also an important feedback mechanism from the financial markets into the bank. The Reserve Bank also works very closely with the National Treasury on market communication as part of the overall policy coordination as it relates to the area of reserve management, public debt management, and financial markets development overall. I think, Mr. Chairman, I'll leave it at that, and we'll be happy to entertain any questions later once my colleague has presented. Thank you.
I think we should proceed and take Brian.
Okay.
His presentation. And after that, then we'll interact with the three sections. Thank you. I'm aware that honorable members, we are being overloaded with information,
yeah.
But we'll find a way to deal with that. Over to you, Brian.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson, honorable members of the committees, and other guests. My presentation will focus on the monetary policy review, which was released by the bank yesterday evening at the National Monetary Policy Forum in Pretoria. Twice a year we publish the monetary policy review, where we try to give an overview of recent inflation trends, the factors that we see as having impacted on inflation, and our monetary policy responses to that. By way of introduction, there are signs that the global economic recovery is underway, but we're aware that this recovery is hesitant and very uneven across different regions and countries. But it does appear that since the second half of this year, the global economy has been recovering. The domestic economy was not spared the fallout of the global downturn, and in the second quarter of 2009, the economy recorded a third successive quarterly contraction. But as we'll see, there are signs that the turnaround is in process. With respect to domestic inflation, this has continued to trend downwards, reaching a level just above the inflation target range in September 2009. Now, looking at the recent developments in inflation, as we can see from this graph, during 2008, inflation peaked at a level of 13.6% in August, and since then has been coming down quite consistently, and in the last month of recording, in September 2009, CPI inflation was 6.1%, marginally above the upper end of the inflation target range. Now, what are the main contributors to inflation? If we look at this table, we see that food and non-alcoholic beverages, if we look in March, when overall inflation was 8.5%, food and alcoholic beverages at that point contributed 2.3 percentage points of that 8.5. So that was the biggest driver of inflation at that point. By September, as we'll see, food price inflation had come down significantly, and when inflation measured 6.1%, food prices only contributed less than 1% of that. The other significant point to note is the contribution of transport. In 2008, the transport component was one of the biggest contributors to inflation, mainly through petrol price increases, but with the collapse of the international oil prices towards the end of 2008, the basic petrol prices declined, and we've seen that the transport component up to now has been a negative contributor to inflation due to the petrol prices this year being significantly lower than those of last year. If we try to see the effect of food and petrol and electricity prices on headline inflation, if we exclude petrol prices, we can see that inflation would have been 7.1%. In other words, petrol prices, as we saw, were currently reducing reducing pressure on inflation. If we exclude food prices, again, we would have seen in the last month, we would have seen a higher inflation rate because food prices are now less than average inflation. And then if we exclude food and petrol prices, we would have had a level of 7.5%. And then finally, if we exclude energy prices as well, the inflation rate would have been 7.1%. So what that's saying, in effect, is that the electricity prices increases in September added 0.4 percentage points to inflation during that month. Now, just a brief word on the food prices. During 2008, food prices were quite significant. As we can see from this from this graph, in 2008, food prices, if we look at the red line, it peaked in the middle of or the second half of 2008 at levels of around 17%. So that was a major driver of inflation. Since then, we've seen this red line coming down. In other words, food price inflation has been moderating. As we saw, it contributes less to inflation now. The latest figure for food was about 4.9% in September. And we can see the reason for that is the underlying pressures coming from the producer price level have dissipated. This blue line here are the agricultural commodity prices. In 2007-2008, we had very high rates of increase in agricultural commodity prices, both domestically and internationally. With the beginning of the crisis, along with all other commodities, agricultural commodity prices also declined and moved into negative territory. Just as an example that's relevant to us, the maize price last year, in the middle of last year, was about 2,000 rand per ton. It's now around about 1,300-1,400 rand a ton. So it's not only a decline in inflation, in maize price inflation, it's an absolute, a very big absolute decline, which then also feeds through to the production prices and then ultimately to food prices. So the production prices, the green line of manufactured foods and of the agricultural commodities, those prices are actually falling, which means it's now beginning to feeding through significantly to overall food price inflation. If we look at administered prices, the total administered prices, which includes regulated and unregulated prices, the total inflation rate was 3.2% in February, in September, but and that's because regulated prices were so low. But part of the reason, the main reason for the decline in regulated prices, was due to the price of petrol. In the unregulated prices, the most important component there that was putting upward pressure on these were assessment rates that the municipalities charge. Looking at the producer price index, we see that the producer price index has remained in negative territory for quite a few months. The overall producer price is reflected by this red line. And we can see that it is negative. The latest number was minus 3.7%, and that was driven mainly by, we can see domestic outputs, the green line is also negative, but the sharply negative line comes through from imported commodities. So that's a combination of a relatively strong exchange rate and also quite weak commodity prices. This gold line up here is the electricity prices, which have been increasing round about between 28% and 30%, and that is putting upward pressure on the producer prices. We then consider the different factors that affect inflation. In the Monetary Policy Committee, we would be focusing on these factors to try and get a view of, to try and understand how these factors have been affecting inflation and how they're likely to affect inflation in the future. And in the end, these all get assimilated into our forecasting model, which then generates our forecast. And on that basis, we then try to assess whether there's an upside or downside risk to that forecast. Now, the first thing that we look at when considering the determinants of inflation is the global situation. As we know, we've been through one of the worst, the worst recession since the Great Depression in the 1930s. In 2008, world GDP growth was 3%. Now, if we bear in mind that already in the third and fourth quarter, we already went into negative growth, this average of 3% is probably understated for the early part of 2008. In 2009, the average growth rate for the world economy was -1.1%. So recessionary conditions. This is an estimate for 2009. We do have up to third quarter growth rates already. What we can see here, firstly, that the advanced economies, the US, Japan, Euro area, UK, and other advanced economies, were all significantly negative. Output was contracting. In the developing and emerging market economies, generally we still had positive growth, except in the Central and Eastern European and in the Commonwealth of Independent States and in the Western Hemisphere, which is mainly Latin America. But the rest of the developing and emerging markets had positive growth, but significantly lower than what was previously. Of equal importance to us, are the inflation rates. We saw in 2008 world inflation had gone up to around 6%, mainly because of strong commodity price developments in the first half of the year. But with the with a major downturn and the decline in commodity prices, we see that world inflation is down to around about 2.5%. Inflation in the advanced economies is either negative or very, very low, higher though in the emerging and developing economies, but generally in single-digit territory. One of the big global factors for us is the price of Brent crude oil, or the international oil prices, which feed in quite significantly to inflation. I'm sure you all recall the increase in the price of Brent crude oil to $150 per barrel, or just under $150 per barrel in 2008, in August 2008. It then came down quite precipitously to below $35 per barrel at the end of last year. Since then it has recovered, but for the last 2-3 months it's remained in the region of between $65 and just under $80 per barrel. Futures prices show that there is an expectation that these prices might rise, but not there's no expectation of a massive rise. The price for delivery next June is around $82 per barrel currently. Looking at other central banks' monetary policy responses, in the first column we have the bank rates or repo rates at or official policy rates at the 1st of September 2008, just before the collapse of Lehman Brothers, and then the second column gives us the current rates, and we can see that there have been significant reductions in monetary policy rates throughout the world. But if we look at the last column, that is the most the latest decision. And we see that generally policy rates have been left unchanged most recently. So in other words, we seem to be at the bottom of the global interest rate cycle. Most recently, there are only three countries that have increased their rates, and that is Norway, Australia, and Israel. When we look at some of the emerging markets and developing countries, we see that the policy rates are generally much higher, and that is a reflection of the fact that inflation rates in these countries are also much higher than in the advanced economies. Another important factor which we consider is the exchange rate. Obviously, the exchange rate changes the impact on domestic price developments. During the crisis last year, the rand went from levels of around 8 rand to the dollar to around about 11.80, then stabilized around 10 rand to the dollar, and then since then has moved back to to current levels of around 7.50 to the dollar, more or less where it was trading in the middle of last year. Similar picture with the euro area. This top graph gives us the trade weighted, and it's inverted. So here where it moves up, it is an appreciation. So we have seen an appreciation in the last few months of the trade weighted rand back to levels more or less where it was in the middle of last year. Part of the reason for the strong movement in the rand over the last few months is, firstly, as I indicated, a recovery from those low levels. What we saw happening was that global risk aversion had declined. Money that previously had moved out of emerging markets back to the U.S. and other advanced economies was now moving back into the emerging market economy. So we had this wall of money coming into emerging markets, partly as a response to improved outlook in these countries, also recovering commodity prices, and also because of the overall general weakness of the US dollar. Wage costs are an important focus for us because unit labor costs feed into the inflation process to the extent that higher wages may be passed on as into final prices. What we saw in 2008, if we look at this blue line, the thin blue line, which is the remuneration per worker, we saw that increasing quite significantly in 2008 to over 12%, and that was probably in response to the high inflation rate that had emerged, as we saw earlier. But since then, as the as inflation has started to decline, we have seen a reduction in this remuneration per worker. Labour productivity, we can see, has declined, but this is really a reflection of the fact that output has been falling by more than labour shedding, and the overall nominal unit labour costs then have also been declining. So unit labour costs have been feeding through into inflation, but appears to be moderating, but still at relatively high levels. We see a similar picture here where average wage settlements, the red line, moved up in 2008. Average wage settlements were around 9.8%. For this year to date, around 9.4%. We then move on to looking at the pressures coming from the real economy or lack of pressures. As we know, gross domestic product growth was negative from the fourth quarter of last year, minus 1.8%. First quarter of this year, minus 6.4%, and minus 3% in the second quarter. Now, what this means is that our output is well below our potential, so there are no supply-side pressures in this sense coming through on inflation. It is also a reflection. It also got reflected in the increased number of unemployed, as we saw in the last quarter. According to the labour force survey, about 500,000 jobs were lost. Underlying this decline has been a general decline in household consumption expenditure. Household consumption expenditure has been negative since the second half of last year, and in the first quarter of this year, it declined by 4.8% and 5.8% in the first two quarters, respectively. So very weak demand coming from households for reasons that we'll come to. Gross fixed capital formation, which is overall investment in the economy, was very low from the fourth quarter. There was a bit of a spike in the first quarter, but again in the second quarter, very low levels of investment. Developments in the external sector also reflect the weak economy, where we see that imports have declined by less than decline in exports, and overall the current account deficit to GDP ratio declined from 7% in the first quarter to 3.2% in the second quarter. Now, some of the factors underlying these expenditure trends are reflected through wealth effects. In other words, when people feel poorer because their value of their assets have declined, they will be spending less. Part of that comes through in house prices. What we see here in 2009, that these various house price indices, as the APSA, Standard Bank, and the First National Bank indices, were all in negative territory in the early part of this year. In other words, they all measure house price developments in different ways and different segments, but they all were showing that house prices were in fact falling. But more recently, we have seen some recovery. The APSA House Price Index is now showing a small increase in the average house prices in the middle segment. First National Bank still negative, but very slightly negative, and the Standard Bank median house price index also appears to have turned around. But nevertheless, the housing market is still weak, and that means weak collateral for potential consumption. Share prices are also important from a consumption point of view because the value of people's pension funds and other savings are reflected in this. This graph shows the extent to which South Africa moved in line with the global trends. This light blue line here is the All Share Index. That went down quite significantly towards the end of last year. You may remember that at one stage the All Share Index was around 32,000. It then fell to about 17,000, so almost halving. But since then, there has been a recovery. The recent low point was in early March, and since then it has recovered by about 50% since the March values. Fiscal policy is also an important determinant of inflation. Now, until recently, as you know, government has been running a small budget surplus, which meant that there was very little pressure on inflation coming from government. More recently, in February, a deficit of 3.8% was budgeted for, and in the recent MTBPS, this was changed to 7.6%. From an overall inflation point of view, we don't see this as a problem. We see that this is a result mainly of a decline in revenue due to the lower output, and as such, is part of the automatic stabilizers that are working. And we do see that government is committed to reducing this deficit gradually over the coming years as economic activity picks up. Now, moving on to the conditions in the credit market, these are also significant because what we've seen here is that credit extension, and this is the ability of consumers to borrow, credit extension has been very, very low. In the last, in September, loans and advances, in fact, were minus 2% to the private sector was minus 2%, which is the lowest figure in about 40 years. All the categories of credit extension were negative, that is, installment sales and leasing, credit card advances, general advances, overdrafts, etc., except for mortgages, which was positive, but at a low level of 4.8%. This situation is partly a result of a lack of demand for credit, but also a result of tighter credit criteria being applied by banks. So it's something coming through on the supply side and on the demand side. Now then, those are the major factors that we would have been looking at. Just to say a few words about monetary policy, the global financial crisis resulted in widespread adoption of more accommodating monetary policy. South Africa's monetary policy easing began in December 2008, and in the four MPC meetings between then and April 2009, the repo rate was reduced by 350 basis points. And then since then, which is the period covered by the monetary policy, this monetary policy review, there have been six meetings, and we reduced by a further 150 basis points to its current level of 7%. Here we can see that from 2006 onwards to the middle of 2008, there was a gradual increase in the repo rate by 500 basis points. And then in the space of a few months, we had this aggressive reversal of this by 500 basis points back to 7%. This 7% is back to the same level that it was in 2006, and in fact is the lowest level of the nominal repo rate since the late 1970s. The difference between now and in 2006 is that now the inflation rate is significantly higher than it was in 2006, so in effect the real rate is lower than it was at that point. Monetary policy over this point was adopted as usual in what we call a flexible inflation targeting framework, which focused on bringing inflation down within the target over a reasonable time frame, and the committee remained sensitive to the cyclical growth considerations as evidenced in the extent to which and the short time over which the interest rate was reduced. Some of the issues noted is that the central forecast, as we'll see a bit later, remained close to the upper end of the target range. So although inflation was outside the target for most of this period and still is, for a long time we have been confident that by next year it would come back into the target range. Inflation expectations weren't adjusting as optimistically as we were, and we'll see that a bit later on as well. The global economy generally over this period, in the initial stages, the global economy recovery was very uncertain, but it became a bit more certain a bit later, although there's still significant risks. And then, of course, the domestic recession and the associated widening of the output gap also played on the analysis of the committee. Over this period, the domestic expenditure, as we've seen, remained subdued as a result of the negative trend in credit extension, the wealth effect that I've mentioned as well. The exchange rate of the rand, in the beginning, when the rand was under pressure, it was one of the big upside risks to the outlook, but over time, the risks to the outlook from that quarter became less intense. Over this period, in the first part of the year until about June, generally the risk to the inflation outlook was seen on the downside, and that allowed for this reduction in the repo rate. As time went by, as trends in the economy looked like they were turning around, the risks, the balance of risk changed, and particularly there were some cost push pressures coming from wage settlements and in particular from electricity prices, which tended to balance the risks more evenly from being on the downside to a more even even keel. And just to look at the outlook for inflation, firstly the global economy, this is quite a telling graph. The red lines, this is for the G20 countries. The red lines show the 2009 growth rates for these countries. The blue line shows the forecast for next year. And we can see that apart from the top four countries, China, India, Indonesia, and Australia, those countries all had positive growth this year. But we can see the blue lines are longer than the red, so they expected to grow faster next year than this year. All the other countries in the G20 experienced negative growth, these red lines, all of them are expected to show positive growth in this coming year. So there is some a strong view that the turnaround has come, but it is fraught with risks and can be a very fragile recovery. Looking at the world as a whole, the IMF predicts growth of 3.1% for the world economy next year, a sort of fairly anemic 1.3% in the advanced economies, and much higher in the developing economies. With respect to consumer prices, there seem to be very few inflation pressures coming through. World inflation of under 3% predicted for next year. The leading indicators of the global economy also generally show the same picture of an expectation of an uptick. With respect to domestic growth, the general forecasts are that growth for this year will have been about round about minus 2%. Next year, according to the Reuters consensus forecast, they're expecting growth around 2.3%, and in the following year, 3.5%. You'll recall that the Treasury forecast for next year was a bit less optimistic at 1.5% for next year, but nevertheless, there are signs that we'll be back in positive growth either in the third quarter or in the fourth quarter of this year. The bank's leading indicator also tends to indicate, we can see this upturn over here. In the last few months, we've had five consecutive increases in the leading indicator, and that would tend to tell us that by the end of the year, the recovery should be well on track. Looking at the surveys of inflation expectations, the blue bars are the surveys for 2019 and 11 that were conducted in the first quarter. The green bars reflect the second quarter and the red bars the third quarter. What we can see that going across in the third quarter, if we just look at the red bars, in the third quarter, the forecast for 2009 was 8.2% average, coming down to 7.5% in 2010 and 7.5% for expected inflation in 2011. So the general view, according to this the BER survey, is that inflation will be coming down. People believe inflation will be coming down, but still believe it to be above the upper end of the target range, although if you look within that, the financial analysts are the only group that believe it will come within the target range. And we also see that in the Reuters survey of CPI forecasts, that the expectation there is that inflation will have averaged 7.2% this year, 5.8% next year, and 5.9% the following year. Another market-based way is to look at the break-even inflation rates, which is the difference between the yield on conventional government bonds and inflation-linked bonds, and that also tends to reflect an expectation of inflation around the 6% level over the coming period. Finally, we come to our own forecast that is generated by the Reserve Bank. If we just focus on this middle, the dark segment of this forecast, which is the central forecast, the span reflects probability distribution around that. But what we are seeing here is that the forecast of the bank shows that we expect to get back to within the targets by the second quarter of next year. We may in fact get there next month or the following month or 1 month, but then it may pop out for a bit. But on a sustained basis, we'll be in the target by the second quarter and remain there, sort of fluctuating around levels between 5.3% and 5.9% until the end of the forecast period, at the end of 2011, when we expect it to average 5.5% for that quarter. Now, built into this is an assumption about electricity prices. We have assumed the current assumption. Our current assumption assumes electricity prices of 25% increases over the coming 2 years. So that is the amount that NERSA had indicated that they would grant Eskom. Eskom then came along with a 45% request. But then, because there are indications that that is now under review, we decided to keep the to keep our assumption at the 25%, and just bear in mind that this does impose that the additional request does impose an upside risk to this to this forecast. But there are also downside risks, and generally, as I said before, we believe that the risks to this forecast are evenly balanced. In other words, there's as much chance of us being wrong on the upside as on the downside. But just by way of conclusion, there are positive signs that the worst of the global recession may be over. While the global downturn was weak, the duration was probably shorter than initially feared. Part of the reason was the decisive interventions undertaken. However, these actions globally will have to be reversed at some point, which could constrain the recovery somewhat. Furthermore, the global recovery will be dependent to a certain extent on the recovery of consumption expenditure in the advanced economies. Recovery in the South African economy appears to be lagging that of the global economy, but there are convincing signs that the low point in the growth cycle has been reached, that positive growth will resume by the fourth quarter of this year. We also note that the global inflation environment also remains benign, which makes it easier for us. The domestic inflation environment has also responded to the weak demand conditions. Even though there are some risks to the inflation outlook, the current monetary policy is deemed to be adequate to moderate inflation further to within the target range, while simultaneously allowing for the resumption of a positive growth trajectory. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Governor, Deputy Governors, and the rest of your team. I think, honorable members, at this point, it might be advisable that we take a comfort break for 5 to 10 minutes so that we can get our... just received today, parliamentary responsibilities like we've actually invited here, and I'm sure there'll be a board meeting very soon. Tomorrow there's a board meeting. Now, honorable members, you also pardon yourselves and pardon everybody else that we have had the opportunity to receive the monetary policy review document, the November one, which is still hot, basically. It's just baked. The information cannot be processed overnight from yourselves. Normally, you'd have wanted to have this document a week or two before to go through this
presentation, but as you be aware that just has been
made available this morning, and probably even the crafters of the document themselves have just finalized it. So what I think would be important for the committee, and I'm going to outline later on how we're going to be interacting with the institution itself, there is a standing invitation about ourselves visiting so that we can get more detailed technical information and so on and so forth. So that in meetings such as this one, it is more around policy issues, not the technical matters that we'd want to go into. It is not how things are done, it is why things are happening. I think that's what ordinary members would be, honorable members would be more interested in. Lest we forget the purpose of the meeting, let me just recap. One, that it was an information sharing session. Two, the presentation of the monetary policy report itself to the committee. Thirdly, we would then have the opportunity to interact with these two presentations or three presentations by asking questions of clarity. And don't feel somehow
limited in terms of the kind of questions that you may need to pose. You are free to do that. But I think in the overall, we will have to determine on how best can we make use of this institution and the information that is presented to us as committees responsible for finance moving forward, not only in terms of today. So I thought I should just shape up our discussions in that regard. But honorable members, you are free to ask questions of clarity and also comment at the same time. Not confined to one specific input, we'll just handle all the inputs simultaneously. Honorable Swart, you'll be followed by another Honorable Swart. Ravi, Harris, you'll be the last one to come. Dennis, let me look at this side. Luyenge, Spindler, in that order. I hope you still remember your number. Okay, good. Over to you, Honorable Swart.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much to the presenters for a very thorough presentation. Yeah, I really enjoyed that. It was very informative. And congratulations from my side to the Governor on your appointment. And I hope you have a very happy tenure as the Governor of the Reserve Bank. Chair, I just want to make a general observation, first of all, to say that, inflation itself affects poor people much more than it affects rich people. That's a fact. And the higher the inflation rate, the worse off poor people are. And therefore, I was very pleased to hear the emphasis that is placed on inflation targeting by the Reserve Bank, and I was very happy as far as that's concerned. Now I get to my questions. The first one is if ESCOM manages to get its way in 45% increases rather than the 25% that you worked on, what will the effect be on inflation? Because, it is rather important that we know that. And then the second question is, your predecessor, Madam Governor, said that he would investigate the possibility of the interest rate regime with particular reference to the difference between the repo rate and what is charged by banks. And I just wanted to know whether there's any progress as far as that investigation is concerned. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Also from our side, congratulations, and we hope it's a very happy tenure. Can I just, there's the whole new debate about the mandate for the Reserve Bank. Can I ask, what is your expectations, and whether you are of the opinion that it should change? Is it really necessary to change the mandate?
Honorable Steve Swart, you'll be followed by Harris, then I'll move this out.
Thank you, Chair.
Dr. Rabi.
Thank you, Chair. From our side as well, congratulations, Governor, and thank you for the presentation. I want to just touch on the issue of the mandate again. If you could give us an indication as to how you see this broadening of the mandate. As I understand it, the Reserve Bank has already said it recognizes the performance of its duties. There's a need to pursue balanced economic development and growth. So clearly there is aspects of growth and employment already in the mandate. If you could just clarify how do you interpret calls for a broader mandate, the debate is very interesting. And secondly, on the issue of inflation targeting, thank you for the focus on the fact that it's a flexible inflation targeting. Clearly there's a lot of debate about that, and thank you. I think we would just need a bit of more information, and possibly just highlighting the point that whilst we're outside of the band at the moment, had we had a rigid inflation targeting, there wouldn't have been a reduction in the interest rates, really. If you could just clarify, explain that a little bit to us, and also the issue of second-round inflation and the need for inflation targeting to address that expectations of inflation. I think that is an aspect that obviously we need to be aware of as well. Then lastly, the issue of the stronger rand and the strength of the rand and the downside and the upside of that, and to what degree should the bank intervene? Clearly, we've got a history of that, but we did notice
earlier this year when you built up your reserves, I think it was in September, October, what impact does that have, and to what degree should the bank intervene, considering the history of similar interventions in the past? Thank you very much, Chippers.
Thank you, Chairman. My question also relates to the volatility of the rand. My party, the DA, supports the fact that the market should determine the strength of the rand. I'd like to have the views of the governor regarding whether there should be any interference to protect the rand. It has an effect on our manufacturing sector. At the moment, the relative strength of the rand, and I'd like to have our views on that. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for the presentation. I specifically enjoyed the presentation on the financial markets. A lot of that content I haven't heard like that since my economics lectures. And the one thing that was happening when I was in the School of Economics was we had just introduced this inflation targeting framework. And the only thing that's different between what I heard then and what I hear now is the addition of the word flexible before the inflation targeting framework. I remember a particularly hawkish professor of mine, he was quite alarmed that right in the beginning we were outside of the inflation targeting framework, and it was a really big deal for him. He thought there was a big credibility problem at that point. Now, clearly, the Reserve Bank has established some credibility since then. But there have been some comments, like the deputy governor's comments in the press, that a non-competitive level for the rand could have adverse effects to the economy. But now, that non-competitive level, on the flip side, would have very good effects for inflation. Now, maybe just to clarify questions which several other members have asked, the primary goal of the Reserve Bank remains the achievement and maintenance of price stability. But if the Deputy Governor is talking about levels of the rand that are non-competitive, those levels would, by definition, be very good for maintaining price stability. How do you justify those two positions, which actually, to me, don't sound compatible? And then just to add a little bit to my colleague's question on the spread between the repo and the prime rate, the research in the publication is very good in this regard, but it refers to the fact that there was a lagged response by the banks to interest rates adjustments. Now, what happens if that lagged response, when interest rates are going down, is matched by an extremely prompt response when rates rise? What tools does the bank have to manage that? Because that would presumably put South African consumers in a bad place. And then two more quick questions, Chair. I would like the governor's view. Obviously, the hindsight is a perfect science, and I was wondering if she would comment on some of the previous decisions by the bank. For example, notwithstanding the increase in impaired advances by the local banks, did the sudden constraints in credit by the South African banks at the time of the global recession not exacerbate the recession in South Africa needlessly? And then secondly, does she feel, in hindsight, that we cut rates too slowly in response to the recession? And then my last question, I understand that it's the Treasury's responsibility to set exchange controls, but the governor and the Reserve Bank is consulted in this regard. You know, Chair, the exchange controls that get all the press are the ones that involve effectively rich people and companies moving large amounts of money in and out of the country. But in my opinion, the exchange controls that have the most damaging effect on the country are simple little ones, like those that prevent South African entrepreneurs that create intellectual property, software and other products online from being able to receive payments for those products from payment systems like PayPal. Now, we've got this extremely comprehensive exchange control framework that's blocking the development of South African entrepreneurs, specifically online and in the software space, from being able to sell their products online like entrepreneurs all over the world can do. Can the governor please comment on her perspective on those exchange controls and how we can, really they seem to me, and I'm sure to most of the members here, to be quite needless, and I would appreciate the governor's view on that. Thank you.
Honourable Luyanga, followed by Honourable Speaker, and then Balinde.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. Let me also join the colleagues that have actually appreciated the appointment of the governor. So my question is around the involvement of the stakeholders of the bank when decisions are being taken, and also an element of public participation in decision making in general. Is there any mechanism that the bank is employing to ensure that whatever decisions that the bank takes have an influence of the broader stakeholder and the general public? Then, secondly, where do you actually locate the bank? Is it in the corporate world, or it is part of the civil service? I'm asking this because we have an oversight body which is a specialist, the Auditor General, where there will be on a yearly basis opinions that are coming from that office. So if you are broadly on the civil service, is there any link that the Auditor General has with the bank? The other issue, Chair, is the issue that relates to the reviewal of the bank's policies. What actually prompts the feasibility and desirability for review of any policy, including the repo rate? Is it at the arrival of the end of the term, or when any incumbent is coming in has a responsibility to make such a review? Because the general outcome that is there, you don't know how to justify it, because when the then governor of the bank was coming in, there was no much noise on the part of the stakeholders and other quarters. I don't know why now. Maybe now there is more democracy than before, and then more transparency. Maybe you don't remember. Then lastly, Chair, there are dark room manufacturers of the banknotes and coins. Is there any mechanism that the bank is using to ensure that there is minimal activities of that nature, and that the companies that are assigned to manufacture such notes and coins, that ensures that there is no illegal access to such coins and notes, and that the bank is monitoring such companies that they only operate within the print scripts that they are supposed to? Thank you.
I think let me take the last I covered. Good. Governor?
Perhaps I can start, and I think some of them overlap, so I'm not going to go necessarily person by person, because I think that some of them overlap, and I'd ask my colleagues to, where I've, some of them in terms of adding and taking up specifically as well. Let me perhaps deal with the last question first, because I think that quite often when you have this number of round of questions, it's the last one that sticks in the mind most. On this question of counterfeit, it's important to know that the bank itself, the Reserve Bank, has two subsidiaries. One is the mint and one is the banknote company. Nobody else can make coin or mint or paper legally. So those are very tightly run. They are our responsibility both in terms of quality, content. They are managed with their own boards in terms of oversight. There's reporting to the main board of the bank, any other subsidiary. But with both of them, the approach taken is something that is as tightly managed as possible. It's obviously, as incoming governor, I will certainly be visiting them and reviewing any reports about whether there is room for tightening up the procedures or anything else. Every single element of it is very carefully managed and accounted for. Does that mean that there's no counterfeit? No. It does mean that we need to look at where it's produced, but if counterfeit does occur, it tends not to be from within the companies themselves. You know, if you look at modern technology, if you look at photocopying, you look at all of these kinds of things, it's not that difficult today. So what we've seen is that there is a regular need to upgrade the security features of your notes. Obviously, the new notes change signature as well, so that will be something else that will change. And again, it maybe provides opportunities for counterfeiters. Counterfeiters are very skilled. That's their profession. Our job is to eradicate it. So we have a team that actually look at this all the time. Anybody who is aware of a counterfeit, we expect them to report to us. They do. We examine the counterfeit, how it's happening, where it could come from, and we certainly try to shut it down. You know, I think that our notes are reasonably secure. It does happen that you do get counterfeit, and if there is, it's often, or so far, it has been quite visible that it is a counterfeit. But there's no way you can take it for granted that that would always be the case. And therefore, as I said, there needs to be a regular updating of what are security features. And a vigilance among the public. If the note doesn't look right, report it, because then we would certainly act on it, and the banks are very conscious of it, and so are we. So I don't think there's a question that other companies engage at all. They don't. It is our companies only, the Mint and the Bank Note, who can produce note and coin. And there's a very tight regime around that. So that, for instance, even if you come and visit us at the bank, you would not be able to go to the Bank Note company. And you'd be able to go to the Mint to look at the shop, but you wouldn't be able to go into the production side. So it's not accessible to the public. But I would assure you that this is something that is very high on the agenda at all times, to ensure that, because it's a confidence question, we must trust our currency and that it's something that we have a store of value in. Perhaps to then start on the question, I'm going to Brian ask you to look at the question of the Eskom pricing. But in terms of the point made, Mr. Swart, about the discussion about the repo rate and the bank rates, the rates that banks charge, that is, a task team was set up jointly. I have asked its status. I understand it is still work in progress in the bank, and we will follow that up. And as soon as there is a report on that, to release it to the public. So I can't comment on the detail of that now, other than to say that, you know, I would follow up the work of that task team. In terms of the mandates and broadening the mandate, let me start with perhaps a different question, or two aspects to this. From the Reserve Bank side, the fact that there is concern and a requirement or a request to discuss the mandate is something that we're very ready and willing to engage with people to understand the concerns, to listen to what people are concerned about in terms of what the existing mandate is, and to go there with an open mind. So I don't want to respond to say, what is my view of a different element of that mandate change? Could it be this? Could it be that? Could it be the other? Could it be nothing? The question for us is a request to say, let us have conversation. I have had a discussion with the Minister of Finance on this. And from the SARB side, we're very ready and willing anytime that they would like to have the conversation to do so. And out of that, listen to the real issues that people are worried about. And then look at what is the role of the Reserve Bank in that, and what is it that we need to or could do. So I have no anticipation about or wanting to preempt that meeting at all. I want to go there from the SARB with an ability to listen to what the concerns are. I think that if one looks at, and again, second round effects, I think that's extremely important, but again, Brian, you'll look at that in your response. Bank intervention in the exchange rates. I think that this is something very important to recognize, that there's not a rate that is a perfect rate. And it is not the bank's task or desire to intervene to find an appropriate or a rate that we feel comfortable with. Because there's different elements to this, and I don't think you can ever achieve that. So it is not the bank's task to intervene in the markets to achieve a particular rate of exchange. We do not do that, and we will not do that. The rate is set by what is happening in the marketplace. Are there implications in both the sense of a strong rand? Absolutely. And the implications for a weaker rand. But you, if you're wanting to intervene, the people will take you on. That is the lesson of the world. And therefore, we do not look at a particular rate. We do not intervene to achieve a particular rate. We look at the opportunities in the market for us to go into the market, as Daniel has outlined, to see whether we need to, we have an opportunity to build reserves, or if we need to create or to find any resources in terms of what government needs are. But it has a purpose in it, which is exactly that, is to say, you know, can we use this opportunity of where the exchange rate is to help us build reserves? Building reserves is costly. You know, we're now just below 40 billion rand. If I recall a few years ago, our net open forward position was about 25 at one point. So you've had a huge swing round of what we've been able to achieve. And therefore, we're not an outlier in the way we were around the reserves. But that is the framework within which we operate. And I think that it's very important to reiterate that any intervention is not about a particular point of exchange rate that we think is a good one, or to try to attain or to keep it within that. We intervene only, or we active in the market only when we're wanting to build reserves at this point in time. So that's what our approach is. The currency is volatile, and there's no question that a volatile currency has an impact. It's an impact on the ability to take decisions. Forward-looking, long-term decisions get impacted. So yes, ideally we want a more stable currency. And that is part of what the management of the whole economy is about and what we need to look at. The flexible inflation targeting approach, again, I'm going to leave that to Brian. I can deal with it, but I think just put it into what you're looking at there. In terms of the banks following the interest rates of the SARB, yes, they do. They do it immediately, same day. It's part of the, and it links a little bit to the mandate, the discussion earlier about, you know, what is the difference between the bank and the repo rate. But in essence, when the repo rate changes up or down, the banks institute that with immediate effect. It announces that day and it's effective the following day. And it's partly the question for us. There's no legal obligation for them to do it, but it is the vehicle through which monetary policy is transmitted. And therefore, there is that cooperation between the banking sector and the bank that what we do with the repo rate is the signal, it is the benchmark, and it is given effect in that way, so that they do. There isn't a lag between that. The difference, of course, is that your repo rate is, as I said, a benchmark if they borrow from us. It's at the margin. It is not their main borrowing. And it is indicative of how they set prime. But every one of you in the room will know that prime is indicative. It depends who you are, where you are, what primarily your collateral is, what your security is, what your creditworthiness is, whether you are going to be at prime, below prime, or above prime. And if you look at some of the elements in the banking sector that deal with micro-lending more or low-income lending, you'll find that their bank charges are way above prime. That's part of what your credit regulator looks at. So the repo rate sets the indications for where prime would be. Prime itself is something that the individual banks look at, and that relates to the creditworthiness and the collateral and the security that individuals have. And that will pitch how expensive it is for anybody to get their mortgage or the other financing that they need for business. So it's a much more complex relationship than simply a straightforward one-to-one that occurs in that regard. Previous decisions of the bank, no, I would not want to comment on that. I think it is not appropriate at all. And involvement of stakeholders, of how to get input from stakeholders, I think there are a number of ways of doing it. This is one. Right? We appear and participate in the NEDLAC process. We have monetary policy forums throughout the country in every province where we invite members of the public, whether from whatever walk of life, individuals, institutions to come. We present exactly the presentation or not the exact, it's done by different members of staff, but it is on the monetary policy review around the country, and that's done with each publication. We also have a process which I'll be looking at of how do we ensure that there is roundtable discussions, the kind of engagements that we have, so people can feed into us. This is very important to have not a one-way street, that we impart information, but we also get people's views in that. Members of the Monetary Policy Committee meeting, members of the Monetary Policy Committee visit institutions, visit factories. We meet with organizations at all times, so that the input into that is through, primarily through organized institutional arrangements in our society, whether it's parliament, business organizations, labor organizations, civil society, etc., through NEDLAC. But we also try to ensure that we meet with people. And the question for me with that is that the more we can enhance that engagement, the better off we are. Because we need to have a society that understands in much greater depth the role of a central bank in society, what it does, what its purpose is, and what it doesn't do. You know, it's one institution, one instrument in a framework of economic arrangements about how you run a country and how an economy works. A very important one, no question about that. But it is that framework, and what you're seeing globally today as a result of the crisis, which I think is very important, is a much greater cooperation between the different branches of government with the central bank. In that you're looking at it, if you looked at the interventions, they've been both from the national treasuries and the central bank in a coordinated approach. And that is not something that has been that common in the past. So I think that there is a very strong outreach program that we need to always build upon. And this, as I said, this is something that I would think is very much part of that. Is the bank part of the corporate world or part of civil service? Well, it's actually neither. It has a unique role and a unique place in that, you know, the central bank used to be a listed company on the JSE. So it was something that you could go and you could buy your shares over the JSE. Now you can do over-the-counter trading, but it is something, it is an institution that follows, if you looked at the accountability side, we have two independent auditors. We produce an annual report. The financials are signed off like any public company. You would find, or you would have the full reports that are accountable. It's available to all members of society. All shareholders would get that. But there's an additional element in that because we act as banker to government and in particular relationships with government, there are parts of the audit that are done by the Auditor General. So that we have a combination in essence that the bulk of the auditing and the sort of standard things that need to be audited are done by two of the top companies in the country, with full shareholder reporting. But there's an element that is done by the Auditor General as well. So we fall between, a little bit between the stools of that. And in terms of governance as well, obviously, I will certainly be looking at, with the new King 3 coming out, how compliant we are. But we are as compliant as we can be with King 3. But there's certain things that a central bank does not comply with. For instance, our accounting procedures and what we follow does not comply fully with IFRS. So in our annual report, we state it very clearly, and the auditors, the external auditors will say very clearly, we do not comply with central with the IFRS in these measures because the central bank, it's very difficult to comply. It doesn't work to comply with that because of the nature of the things that we do. But it's full accountability and full internal, external, and auditor general auditing of the central bank. And that when you get our annual report, you'll see all the financials that are there with full disclosure. I think those cover most of the questions. Barring the interest rate regime and the question of second round effects, I think. Thanks. Brian?
Thank you. I'll start with the ESCOM question, what the impact would be. I think the question was, what would the impact be if they got the full 45%? it's relatively easy to work out what the first round or impact effect would be, because we know what the weight of the electricity is in the CPI, and we can very easily work that out. It's quite clear that relative to our current forecast, that if there had to be a 45% increase over the next 2 years, we're forecasting until the end of 2011. So over that period, starting from the implementation of the 45% in June of next year, very soon we would probably be outside the target range. And so we see in terms of our scenarios that we had run that it does take us out the target. What we are uncertain about are what the second round effects are, because our forecasting models do try to capture the second round effects. And by second round effects, we mean that everyone gets faced with these high electricity bills, but how do they get passed on from the producers to consumers and get reflected then in prices and other services that then affect other prices as well? That is very difficult to calculate how that is going to work, particularly because electricity is such a pervasive input throughout the economy. So there's no doubt there will be upward pressure on prices coming from there. The other complicating factor is that because the increases are so large, the increase on the impact on people's discretionary incomes will be significant as well. So there may be a contractionary impact on consumption, and we don't know how that will then feed through into the overall pricing impact. So to answer your question, there's no doubt that it will have a major an impact of taking us outside the target, but there is a lot of uncertainty with respect to the second round effect. As I mentioned, we have assumed the 25%. If the increase is relatively small relative to that, so for example, if they get 30%, the impact will be relatively marginal on our forecast. With respect to the issue of the flexibility of the inflation targeting regime, maybe I could just expand by saying that there is a distinction generally between what is known as strict inflation targeting and flexible inflation targeting. And by strict inflation targeting, it's simply focusing on inflation only with no concern on any other variables. Now, I don't think there's any, this is a theoretical construct, I don't think there's any central bank in the world that is in such a straitjacket that their policy reactions are simply focused on inflation without any view of the cost in terms of output or any other variable. So the flexibility of the regime comes in when a decision has to be made, are you outside the target? How aggressively do you react to that? Do you try and get back into the target as quickly as possible with possible negative impacts on output, or do you try and smooth that over time? In our actions during the past few years, we have tried to have moderate increases rather than, say, moving up with very large and dramatic increases. The converse is also true in the recent time when we were still above the target. We saw that we would over time get back into the target, but yet we decided to move quite strongly in terms of reducing rates because we knew that the underlying economy was very weak, and we felt that there was sufficient space to give a stimulus to the economy without really impacting excessively on the downward trajectory of inflation. It's true that had we wanted to be get within the target much quicker, we would have been far less accommodating in our stance, but clearly the concern for the economy impacted on our on how we came back into the target. I think that's it. Yeah.
Yes,
there was a question around exchange control. Comment on the approach that the government has adopted with regards to exchange control reform has been that of a gradual liberalization of exchange control. And in that, the reform agenda is informed by consultation as well with the Reserve Bank as the operative arm of exchange controls. The government benefits from input stemming from our interaction with authorized dealers, from which we glean the kind of issues that you were referring to about red tape and issues that might be of nuisance value or add to the cost of doing business. And in that regard, feedback to government in terms of the kind of reforms that might be required without necessarily introducing any major risks to the system. And I think the most recent statements that the minister made in the medium-term budget policy statement were an example of that. There was a fair amount of the announcement dealt with red tape issues. There were issues around opening of foreign bank accounts, things that had to do with removing limits on advance payments for imports. And so from that perspective, the reform agenda is continuing. The issue around CFC accounts and the abolition of the 180-day rule that pertains to when export proceeds needs to be converted into rand. So I think the policymakers are alive to issues that have to do with red tape that may be inhibiting certain business transactions and adding to costs, and it's a question of sequencing and making sure that that program continues in the manner that's been done. So I think that is something that is being attended to.
Okay, so we'll take the last round.
I have noted Honorable Bloom, who will be followed by, in fact, if Mark Allen can access it, then yourself, and then we'll take Honorable Montesi, the last handbook from Honorable Sokol.
Thank you very much, Chair. I also would like to say we are very happy and we really would like to congratulate our governor. Isn't there a gender name for a governor? The problem with that is governance means something completely different. At any rate, we remain with this one. We really are very happy that you are in this position. You mentioned two participations that South Africa is in the only one in the sub-Saharan. You did say in the G20, and there was a second one which I didn't get properly.
It's the Bank for International Settlements. In essence, the Bank for International Settlements is an organization there to support central banks around the world. It's almost like the central bank for central bankers, and it does research and support and some money activities and so on. So, and it has meetings regularly of that group of central bankers that belong to it. I think it's something like 55 central bankers who belong to it.
Thanks very much, because I then was going to ask whether you think this, the participation of South Africa in these involvements, does it yield any benefits for other countries in the continent? For me, that would be very important. The second one, the governor has already answered it, and thank you very much for the answer, because I was also going to ask about the King III compliance. The third one was about the securitization, Brian, which is a new term, really. I've seen it being used and I've heard about it. But I know that as far as other countries are concerned, this does help them in transferring maybe and spreading the risks that they have. I would like to have an idea of what benefit would it be for the South Africans. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. No, Chairperson, my questions, I think, has covered all of them. You know, I personally, I also want to congratulate the new governor. But you see, my two colleagues here, Kulnov and Mama Ye, are not saying it comes from the Congress of the People. I want to say it comes, congratulations comes from the Congress of the People. You are also having our support, Governor. You can depend on us, our support fully.
I'm very pleased that you support the choice of the President.
Exactly, because the President and you are assets of the country. That's why you. I was very much impressed. I was listening to you on the radio on Tuesday when you were saying that you will stay independent. And I know you, that you are an independent thinker and nobody will influence you. But let me come to my to mine. Yeah. Yes. No, I thought that...
Order, Chair. This is the committee. Oh, it's out of order.
Honorable Bloom, can you focus on the...
I'm going to ask this question, yes. I thought that the governor will at least... It was interest rate, but the governor has responded to that one. But I thought that the governor is going to give at least a Christmas box to the people out there for at least Christmas to lower. But you have responded to that, and there's nothing else that we can do, Governor. But next time, please think of a Christmas box, Governor.
Honorable Muntisi.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think from the presentation here on the slides, it's quite clear that the ESCOM 45% hike is going to affect inflation or even food prices in one way or the other. I just wanted to check very quickly with the Reserve Bank whether the regulator did actually consult with the bank before they requested for this hike for ESCOM, and whether also what was the opinion of the bank on this particular request. Thank you.
Honorable Sogoni.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think that the colleagues have really covered me, Chair. But the other question that one would like to understand is, I mean, within the monitoring that the bank is doing, I noticed that the food and non-alcoholic food beverages were contributing. I mean, were some of the high contributory factors to the inflation. Now, I thought that perhaps the bank would say it's petrol, it's oil. If it were oil, I mean, is the bank, for instance, happy with the current price of oil as it stands now? And if perhaps with these prices, your role of monitoring, does it stop at just monitoring? Is there any contribution that you do beyond monitoring? You monitor, you find that this is the situation, and so on, and beyond that. I think the question of electricity has been raised over and over. I see here in the report of the monetary policy, there's a mention of the deceleration in credit extension. I don't know if you can comment as to what is the impact of the allowance of the National Credit Act, I suppose. Was it a negative? Was it a negative thing? Was it I suppose that the report is saying was positive. Why would you say that it was negative? Because I think the intentions were good in terms of reducing reckless crediting. You know, I think that but also the other thing that was mentioned to us that would like to understand more is this haircut. I mean that term of the haircut. But just on the lighter side, I'm not sure if the appropriation committee would be happy if on this issue of I think the deputy governor that mentioned that sometimes deliberately the shortage that you create. I hope that you don't create it on the day when the minister wants to table a budget and he finds that there's no money to take. Okay, fine. I think deputy governor, you are.
Perhaps I'll start again and ask my colleagues to pick up as well on some of the questions. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. Perhaps in terms of the first question, the benefits of the BIS to other countries. You know, we have a lot of engagements with other countries. We have meetings of the CMA, we have meetings of SADC, and we have meetings of the central bank governors of sub-Saharan Africa. And therefore, in all of these engagements, it's not what's important for us is that those engagements should help inform our own contribution in these forums. Some of those are engagements by the banks, and some of them are with the National Treasury, and some of them are National Treasury engagements or interactions. So very important for us would be an interaction with colleagues on the continent so that not only do we have a sense of what their concerns are, but when we've had meetings, there's a way of feeding back to them some of the issues that arise in the meetings. And therefore there are regular meetings organized throughout the year in those different formats. So you have the CMA, you have the SADC, and you have the central bank governors. Obviously, I haven't yet had the opportunity to participate in that. The first CMA meeting that I will be going to will be in early December. So it is a two-way street that we would like to and certainly look at how to ensure that there is a flow of information between us so that the continent as a whole feels that when we are there, we have at least had some interactions with them. It's a very important area. On securitization, Brian, I know it's fully done in the booklet here, but perhaps you'll deal with that. Honorable Member Bloom, I think it's important, and I thank you very much for your statement that I have an independence of mind. I also think I do, and my interactions with you over many years, I think you have found that too. But I think it's important just to say that an independence of mind, an independence in exercising your decisions, does not mean that you're opposition. Right? The central bank is here in the interest of the country, and it is not an opposition institution. So I was, you know, independence has often been interpreted or becomes interpreted that if you're independent, you're opposed. That is not the position of the central bank. The central bank exercises its decisions, exercising its independence of operational responsibilities, independence of thought, and part of that is because you're looking at what is necessary to do. But I just thought to draw the distinction that there shouldn't be any confusion that when we talk of independence in the institution, it is not that the institution is opposed. And I think that's a very important distinction to draw. Honourable Member Mansisi, very nice to see you again. I haven't seen you in so long. The question of the regulator consulting with us, I really want to ask perhaps the colleagues who've been there longer because I've only, as I said, come in. I know that we have, and the Reserve Bank has a responsibility and a role, but obviously we have a resource, we look at the data, we have the numbers, and our interaction in terms of law and the Constitution is through the National Treasury. And therefore, if they require support or information or work with us, we do that. But it is through that interaction. I don't know whether there's been a separate interaction with the regulator, but I would be surprised because in terms of that, our interaction, the resource of the institution is there and interacts through the National Treasury. So that the input into the debate would be coming through the political role and the evaluation that's being taken through the National, through the Minister of Finance.
We would certainly have a role as effective and set our views on what the implications are. But the relationship of the Reserve Bank is with the National Finance and the National Treasury. Now, I have to elaborate that there's an ongoing interaction. We have three working committees that look at different elements in macroeconomy, financial stability, and those meetings that are held regularly between the two organizations. I think that that is where that would take place. In terms of, I would just deal perhaps a little bit with this deceleration of credit and the National Credit Act, if I could, and general view of the money market shortage and the paper. Perhaps in terms of this, you know, this is much more complex than it would seem just from the numbers. There's definitely been a very marked decline in terms of what type of credit spending is, and you saw the numbers in terms of that it's only mortgage credit. But it is not only the lending from the bank, it's also the borrowing. There's very high household indebtedness. A lot of people are much more conscious and aware of what it means to them to be as indebted as they are, and therefore are not necessarily borrowing at this point in time. The second question on the National Credit Act and its effectiveness, I think it has been a great help. But in terms of actually ensuring that there is an examination of the credit worthiness and the ability to add more credit to the client at a point in time. But what it does do is impose on the bank to examine exactly that. And therefore, if people who are highly indebted are asking for credit now, they're not likely to get it because it is the very act itself that says if you have examined that, and see that the person is not creditworthy, you are responsible when they cannot pay. So it works in the sense of trying to prevent a person or bank to be responsible lending. But when what you're seeing is that some people say, well, we can't get loans now. Part of it will be because the Credit Act is working. And it's creating a situation where people who are highly indebted are not able to get more credit. So, is it of concern? I think it is, we must bear in mind that there's two levels to this. Certainly banks are looking at collateral, they're looking at prices, lending criteria, statements from the bank that indicate that they are easing that to some degree. But there's also the question from the consumer side about the greater caution around credit lending in the climate that we found ourselves in. Because the reality is South Africa, that people are concerned. One, job security, there's a higher level of unemployment, what is happening to them. So people are being much more conservative and much more cautious. So I think there's a mixed effort to this deceleration. And I think it does reflect that the National Credit Act was a very important tool in creating some caution about lending that needs to be very well examined. But part of it is that people can't be credited because the act is working as well.
Thank you very much. I maybe can start with the securitization question, then put up with the requirement shortage. I think the question is whether South Africa could make use of securitization. Yes, securitization obviously is part of the sort of financial innovations that we have seen in the market, which basically has to do with a conversion of illiquid assets on balance sheets into marketable securities, and through that, certain institutions that engage in these transactions have been able to free up resources to be able to support growth by being able to lend more, because essentially through that they can move certain elements of those assets off the balance sheet. But then there are various forms of the securitization and various levels of complexity. And as part of this financial crisis, the category of securitization, which has been subject to sort of highly leveraged and complex structuring and with huge amounts of complex derivatives that we attach to them, are the ones that have gone into the trouble, or as a principle, the sort of the basic forms and straightforward forms of securitization are helpful. These other ones did cause problems. South Africa has indeed had a fairly large market for securitization. I think in 2007 there's a box in the NPR which gives some details in that regard, up to 30 billion or so. But in the wake of the global dislocation, particularly affecting this segment of financial market innovation, things have cooled down a little bit, and so we haven't seen securitizations. I think this year there haven't been any transactions at all, really, not on the books last year. But having said that, the registrar of banks conducted in April last year a very thorough review of the types of securitization schemes that South African banks have been involved in, and gave them a pretty clean bill of health. Those were well managed and well structured, and were generally not of the nature of the highly complex securitization structures that we've seen elsewhere in the world. So I think with the market recovering and confidence returning, one will probably be able to see that instruments being used once more. The issue around the shortage and the structural sort of liquidity requirement, I think maybe explaining a little bit more. What we refer to is this requirement essentially that I've talked about, that is embedded in the Bank Act, that requires banks to deposit 2.5% of their liabilities with the bank. And that is really to create a mechanism whereby they can be, if you wish, dependent on the central bank to lend to them, through which then the repo mechanism, the transmission of the policy that the MPC has set, is then effective. Essentially, with the liquidity requirement, we refer to the actual amount that the system needs to get from the central bank to allow the individual banks to square off and finalize their transactions at the end of each business day. So it's not come to a situation where it's actually a shortage of cash, and that's for any entity not to be able to complete transactions. The issue of the haircut is to do with the refinancing mechanism that we offer when we lend to the banks. As I indicated earlier, we are not allowed to lend on an unsecured basis according to the Act. So what it relates to is how we value the security that we get given, the collateral that we get given when we lend to the banks. So we will take that security at whatever 95 defend on that standard of 5% of its value is sent into account, because these are tradable securities with market prices fluctuating on a daily basis, just to account for that volatility in prices that will occur, so that when we then realize that security, there is that element of buffer and margin of safety. And depending on then how the market moves, there is then a need to ensure that that ratio then gets maintained, either when the banks may have to post additional collateral, or if it's too much, we then have to release some of the collateral.
Brian, I think there was just a question of the food contribution to inflation. And the current price of oil, whether we sell, how we sell stuff at current price.
As I've indicated, the food prices at some stage were the single biggest contributor to the inflation outcome. But that has come down quite significantly. What we've seen over the years is that there are phases that food prices go through with, and that could be determined by international prices and by weather conditions when food prices go higher. So we do tend to see the contribution of food fluctuating quite significantly over time. At this point in time, food prices have come down, food price inflation has come down quite significantly. So it's now at the point where it's actually pulling down on average inflation rather than pulling up on average inflation. And that has been so for the last month or so. And we expect that trend to continue for the months going forward, because we see at the producer price level that prices are still falling. So that's something that we, that's some good news in the system. With respect to the oil price, that's difficult for us to say whether we're happy with a particular price. Our focus is more on the rate of increase of the price rather than the actual price itself. I think that when we saw prices going down to $35 per barrel at the end of last year, obviously everyone, all the consumers were really happy, the producers were not really happy. But we, in a sense, we knew when it was down at $35 a barrel that was not going to be sustainable. And so we saw a reduction in petrol prices going down to about 6 rand per litre. But then as the international prices normalised, we saw petrol prices going up again. So in some senses, the international oil prices now are at levels where OPEC has indicated that they are more or less happy with. But we don't know, but if they had to go higher again, they may be happier with a higher price. But I think that the very low prices were unsustainable. But at this point in time, petrol is not imposing a huge impact on the current inflation outcomes, because the changes relative to last year are helping to bring inflation down, and that's why we've got this negative effect.
Perhaps just a small point is that I might have said when I was talking about the foreign reserves that we had just under 40 billion rand, it's actually dollars. So if I did say rand, it's certainly wrong, it's dollars. Just in case I said rand, thank you.
Thank you, sir. My purpose in the I think that in your opinion, the map and meaningfully really comment is that looking forward to working with arguing for a further effect. We think we have to also increase the appropriation.
Just to indicate to you that in actual fact this is the last committee meeting of our program basically for this year. In fact, honorable members were very much citizen throughout the year, and I think we're looking forward to this meeting. If I've not scheduled this meeting to be the last, I'm sure there are difficulties to correct. But you can see by the attendance that everybody is here, we've been looking forward to interact with you. But most importantly, there's been a very, very good team that moving forward, you should look for more combative interaction with this team. But more on the primary responsibility of Reserve Bank, I think it's important to, so that when we say this is how we're going to work with the Reserve Bank, we understand the premise from which it is coming from. The primary responsibility or the primary goal of the Reserve Bank, it is captured in all the documents. It's either with the annual report, is to ensure that in contributing in the growth of the South African economy, price stability is central. But central to that price stability is also the financial stability in the economy. Through which you are able to effective interventions in making sure that the economy goes in the right direction in the country. But in terms of financial stability, you also have various tools that you use, amongst others, to give the banking regulations and supervision. Now, I'm raising this matter because I think as a committee will also be interested in getting some sort of information on how this banking system works and how can we help as a committee. The other important point that I think we should mention here, you would know as a governor, as you've been here before, that Parliament today has got a greater role to play in the economy. But more often than not, I hear even people in the media, when they comment about it, the role of Parliament in the economy, they narrow it to the role of Parliament in terms of the new Money Bill Amendment Act, as if it's just about the budget. But it's about the role of Parliament in the economy. It's not just about presenting the budget and counting figures, fiscal policy framework. It's about the role of Parliament in influencing the direction of the economy in South Africa. Now, given that we are going to be playing a very important role in shaping up the direction in which our economy goes, let's say, as Parliament, it also calls upon us as Parliament, through our committees, to relook on how we relate with the Reserve Bank, defined in terms of the Constitution, what is expected of the Reserve Bank insofar as Parliament is concerned. But I think we'll have to go beyond what has become the rituals in the past years. Tabling and taking annual reports, quarterly reports, and other relationship that Parliament would have had with the Reserve Bank. I think what would also be important for us as a committee is that let's go beyond this normal practice and begin to use your economic analysis before or just after the budget, so that when we deal with our medium-term policy statement, when we deal with the main budget itself, the public hearings and so on and so forth, we have the analysis from the Reserve Bank. Therefore, we may not necessarily have to meet with you on quarterly reports and annual reports only. Expect to be called from time to time, of course we'll communicate in time, to come and make a presentation to us so that this honorable member are better positioned to can interpret the budget in relation to the economy. I think it is very, very critical that we look into this matter from that angle. We will therefore probably have to meet with you early in the year in terms of the budget, main budget itself, but also during the MTBPS period. But in between, we'll need to have an understanding of what our financial market is like, because the current global crisis stems from the financial sector. Therefore, it means the regulatory environment was to a very large extent, if not for the best. So we would want to be on our toes on that particular matter. Having said that, Governor, I think you have been welcomed by almost everybody. But we also want to say to you, we wish you well in your new job. Hopefully your board meeting tomorrow will be as good as this meeting that you had with us today. We also want to take the invitation that you have extended to us within that context of us beginning to understand the work of the bank, but also the empowerment that committee members would need from your institution so that we can be able to do what we are supposed to do. And I want to continue to define this matter beyond the Money Bill Amendment Act as if that is the only issue, it's about the economy of South Africa. And we cannot be able to deal with that particular matter unless we have the proper analytical tools of understanding where the economy is going, not only in the country but throughout the world. So, the honorable members, you are invited not to lunch, there's no lunch left today on your last day. I'm told there were two members who, unlike myself, who have never born of woman folk in terms of Shakespeare, two honorable members who were born this month. That's Honorable Desmond Green and Honorable Balinkia. So we'll have the week as they organize something for yourselves. So that's the only lunch in our farewell as we go into Christmas. wish you all the best and go and take a little bit of a rest, because next day it is going to be very, very hectic, especially in the first part of the year, before the World Cup. At least you have some time to go and watch soccer there and there. Governor, over to you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and Co-Chairperson. It really is from our side just to say thank you to all of you. I think the point you've made about the engagement is most welcome. We can practically look at dates so that we can ensure that we can meet your requirements and be available in the manner that we need to. I do feel I would agree with you that it's very useful for the committee to have a greater awareness of what's happening in the banking system and the transition more broadly. I think that should be one of the topics for discussion. It's very important, very pertinent. And we would certainly look to welcoming you at the Reserve Bank and look forward to the dates that you have proposed for us. And it would be extremely helpful for all of us to have that kind of engagement. And thank you for your congratulations today and for warm support and the questions that you've asked. And thank you very much to the Reserve Bank team for coming down to be part of this. Thank you very much.
Might have all went. Thank you.